to Insights Group Live. Hi, this is Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Cecilia Velas-Tiki. She is the author of Gathering Indigo Maidens. Cecilia was born in Quito, Ecuador, where she spent her childhood. She received her graduate degree from the University of Southern California and speaks four languages. She lives with her family in Dana Point in California. Gathering of the Indigo Maidens, the book that we're going to be talking about today, is an epic tale of a wealthy South California widow who becomes reluctantly embroiled in the Spanish colonial arms theft and sex slavery of young Ecuadorian girls in California in 2008. We'll be talking with Cecilia about sex slavery and the art theft as we know it today. Hi, Cecilia.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, this is really great to talk to you. Our reviewer loved your book, and I know that there are some issues in it that are really relevant to our society right now, and one of the ones that I really want to kind of talk about right now is the human trafficking that happens with the Latin American girls and teens, and how they're sort of caught up in this underworld of sex trafficking. Just give us a little insight as to what really is going on.
Well, it is a very serious problem, and one that is very hard to believe that it's happening, particularly when we think about the girls that are being trafficked to the United States. I think the assumption by many people is, of course, that this has always happened, and it's happened in other parts of the world. But in many ways, the root of the problem is an economic problem. Many of the girls have left their countries because of economic reasons. So it's really been an economic diaspora. And in the process of any time that there's people wanting to leave for economic reasons, for any reason, there are those that want to profit from them. So the way the system appears to work in these underbelly of life is that in the small villages where these girls are coming from, a woman, usually a middle age, will go there and talk to the girls and promise their families that these girls are going to be taken care of, and she will personally escort them, and they're going to be working in very reputable jobs when they arrive, either in Europe or to the United States. And, of course, the parents know that their girls are coming illegally. They don't have any documentation, but they still will bring their passport just in case. And once they arrive to the whatever location is in the United States, then, of course, the girls have absolutely no way of getting out of it, because they're in a country they don't know. They're with someone who they no longer see, that individual that transported them, and they're caught in a situation where they can't get out of. They're kept in bordellos, if you will.
Uh-huh.
These bordellos get moved around from town to town, city to city, and so they're forced to stay in that situation. And one of the ways that they force them is, of course, is to supply them with drugs, so they keep them drugged up, and that's how it continues.
Wow. Are there any statistics or numbers that you're aware of as to how many girls there really are, let's say, in the United States?
Well, you know, I've heard many statistics, and I'm not in law enforcement, and I'm not in the Justice Department, so I hate to cite any, but there are definitely in the – I've heard 14,000, I've heard 24,000, you know, so many numbers, so – I prefer not to really cite any numbers, other than to me, even one person is too many. But it's enough that it is a very serious crime in many cities. Certainly, where in Orange County, California, the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force is very important, and they're doing a lot of activities to let the public know that this is taking place. And obviously, the reason is because it is very prevalent.
So you mentioned Orange County. Are there other areas in the United States that you're aware of where it is heavily sex trafficked?
The way I understand it, it's really everywhere.
Really?
And it's just a matter of finding out, you know, the way where there's a lot of immigration, recent immigration, so it might be to the southeast now,
sure.
Florida, Mississippi, all the areas where there are agricultural workers, obviously in the heavy populated industrial areas, pretty much everywhere.
Cecilia, are there, you know, this appalls me, and I think it's horrible. It's horrible to exploit these girls, and I'm just surprised that there isn't more, you know, control over that. But did you find in your research that there are specific countries that are targeted in the Latin American?
Well, it's always the ones that have the most dire economic situation, and it fluctuates. For example, in my novel, I deal with Ecuadorian girls, and in the late 90s, early 2000s, their currency was totally devalued, and so they had a crisis. Because of that crisis, many of them went initially to Spain, and that's where I initially personally saw these young Andean girls, which their physical characteristics are so much different than the Spaniards, although they have a Spanish history to their countries. And that's when I kind of started probing. This was back in 2001, because they just seemed so out of place, beside the fact that this was they were walking, prostituting themselves in a very lovely area of Madrid. So it was so incongruous to me, and such a sad thing to witness. And it's so pretty much it's whichever country is going through the dire.
Yeah.
Right now, it seems to be actually the countries are doing a little bit better. So maybe we won't see girls being trafficked from there as much.
In your research, what did you find? Did some of these girls actually are able to get away, or, are there forces that go in and actually take these girls out and send them back home, or what happens?
Well, obviously this is a very very active program that's run by, I think, all the countries. I know certainly here in California, they have a very active police department looking for them, and there's a system that the way that they are I hate to say captured, but the way they are rescued,
right,
the system that they go through. But because they are usually here without any documentation, that's where the problem occurs. And if the girls choose not to to serve as witnesses against their perpetrators, they get the counseling. There's many ways that they do for the client services. But eventually, and I think what I like to deal with, my background being in psychology, is that these are really broken girls. And although we may offer services as a society to help them, there are very few that are really that strong. And so they don't end up in a good situation, whether they go back to their homes or are able to stay here in the United States. These are girls that have really been broken down.
Yes, I hear you. And also the fact that they are broken down, but also they come to a country where it's totally different culture. And I'm sure that this is not very easy for them either, because all of a sudden they're promised, the moon and all these wonderful jobs and looked after, and all of a sudden they come, and as you say, they stay in brothels, and they're, exploited, really, and with no way out. And so I would imagine that, and also just the culture aspects of it, too, this must be just devastating for these girls.
Well, they really never see the light of day. I mean, that's the bottom line. They are caged, and that is the sort of the metaphor that I use.
Uh-huh.
They really are caged. Once they come in, and they come in without any documentation, so they are definitely, in the wrong, if you look at it that way. But once they are here, they're never out in society. We rarely see them, at least in the United States. They're not out really sort of walking the streets. They are being held in these bordellos. In other countries, perhaps one sees them walking around, but these girls we never see, and that's part of the problem, because we don't see them, and unless you're a procurer of their services, unless you're one of the Johns, if you will, we really don't know. And they do move the bordellos around, rental homes, rental apartments, so the girls never see, they don't interact, so I don't think there is even an awareness of where they are.
Wow. It's just hard for me to even imagine.
It is.
How do you even, I'm hearing you talking, and I'm trying to sort of relate to what you're saying, but it's hard for me to do that.
It really is. You're absolutely right, because we look at it in ways of how we deal in society, and we have friends, we have contacts, we know we're not afraid of the police, we're not afraid of reaching out to somebody, but these girls they don't have those skills. They came from very small villages. Mm-hmm. They thought things were going to be different, and there's the element of shame. I think from a psychological point of view, even if they could, if they could, they're so ashamed of what has happened to them that who are they going to reach out to call? Assuming one could call home, how are they going to get back there? We're talking about, thousands and thousands of miles away, and now they would have to divulge what has transpired to them, to their family members, who in most cases they've pulled their money together so that they could send the girls with these supposed employers. And so it's not so not only are they ashamed of what has happened to them, but they know it's an economic loss for their family. Yeah. And in many cases, because they know what villages the girls come from, they're threatened. Well, we will let your family know about what's happening to you. You know, you are now a prostitute, and you know you're doing drugs. And so the girls are it's different levels of hell for the girls.
Wow. So Cecilia, in the research that you did for writing your book, did you actually have an opportunity to talk to any of these girls?
No, I did not.
You did not?
No, I did. Other than my initial girls that were there when I saw them in Madrid, and I did talk to a couple of them, but they were drugged and they looked very fearful, and they wondered why is this woman woman approaching us?
Yeah.
And you know, of course, since I'm from Ecuador and I was talking to them, I think they were just very wary of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really. All I got from them, I would say, is that they looked very fearful. But more than fearful, I think they looked numb to me. They just weren't making contact.
Yeah. Well, if they're all drugged up and, you know, combine that with fear that they can actually relate to, they would be numbed out.
Absolutely.
And, you know, just walking around as robots, because basically that's all they are, aren't they?
Absolutely. And walking with fear, because although their pimps were nowhere to be seen, they knew that they were being watched. So they were, because one would think, well, why didn't they just run? Why didn't they speak to someone? Because they're so fearful, by then it becomes a sort of a mental game for them.
I'm going to do a little switch here, and I know this is something that also comes up in your book, and the Spanish colonial art that's been being stolen from Latin America. Just fill us in a little bit about this. I think that, you know, unless we're really into art dealing, we're probably not aware of what really goes on.
That's right. We, as a society, we always hear about the big thefts, you know, from the big European museums. So Van Gogh was stolen, such and such was stolen. These are artists that are recognizable. The names, we've heard of them somewhere in our education or somewhere in society. We know that, you know, a Rembrandt is important. But I think one of the reasons that Spanish colonial art doesn't get that kind of coverage is, again, it's the fact that it's not by a known artist. Generally, the artists during the colonial period, which is 1492 to the mid-1800s, but the majority of the art was done in the 1500s to the 1800s, was done in rather anonymous workshops. And so until maybe the 1700s, 1800s, then certain artists did become well-known and they would put their name on their paintings, but it was done through a workshop. And so there isn't that name familiarity by American collectors. So I think that's the main reason we don't hear about it. And the reason why they are valued so much by collectors is because they did follow the European models. So I know in the book I say, if you can't afford a Raphael on the market that you might want, well, there's some incredible Raphael-like paintings painted at almost the same time in the, you know, 1600s in Latin America. So if you're looking at just the beauty of the art and the antiquity of the art, then it is Raphael-like, but it is not. It's in the same model but painted in a different continent.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Cecilia Velez-Tiquet. She is the author of Gathering the Indigo Maidens. As you've heard so far, Cecilia is very knowledgeable of what is really going on in Latin America. And not like she's looking in from the outside, but she's coming from much research and experience. And so why were these paintings not signed?
the root of it is that the painters, the indigenous painters that, uh-huh. that were from Latin America that were trained by primarily Spanish monks, they were there to produce as much artwork as possible for the Catholic Church so that they could go out and put these paintings on the wall for people that were illiterate. So they really were books, if you will, on catechism.
Stories,
absolutely.
Oh,
Bible
okay.
stories, different kinds of icons, if you will, that the church wanted to teach people. And so they were being painted by the thousands and thousands. And they were all being put on the walls of various churches, monasteries, and even in private homes of that era, of the colonial era. So it was a workshop. And not until...
Mass-produced, really.
Mass-produced,
right.
but under the guidance of a particular master.
Uh-huh.
And eventually some of those indigenous masters became very well-known. And their particular workshops became well known, but it just wasn't the tradition to sign. It wasn't. That's just one of the things that was not done because it was part of their workshop, not necessarily the individual that painted
right.
that entire painting.
It's like a person that made shoes never signed
exactly.
their name to the shoes, so this would be the same thing. It was their job, and they just produced the work.
Absolutely. Although there, as I said, there are several that do stand out through
sure.
through the annals of history.
Sure. And that's understandable. So are you aware of how many of these paintings are actually in private collections now?
No, not by numbers. And I don't think anyone collects it. I mean, there's different databases, but
mm-hmm.
no, there aren't. You know, there's very well-known collections,
mm-hmm.
but there are just as many small collections. And I know in California and in Florida, where there are a lot of... Mediterranean-style homes. Of course,
mm-hmm.
these paintings look beautiful. In
oh,
type
of course.
Of, so it's not, it isn't
yeah.
so much that it's a particular religious reason that anyone would
mm-hmm.
collect, but they do look beautiful in that type of architecture.
Sure.
And so people covet them, and, you know, they're books on how to do a Spanish hacienda, for example,
mm-hmm.
or a Mediterranean home that has these kinds of icons. And so people do collect them.
Well, and imagine eventually it's going to be an investment because as people are more and more aware of what is really going on and as these paintings do come into the surface and into the collectors, I would imagine that eventually there is going to be a price put onto them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But to some degree it's going to be interesting to see if people want to put it back, resell it on the market if they don't have the proper documentation.
Right.
Because obviously a serious buyer would want to see the provenance of a painting.
Uh-huh.
These paintings are more or less in the gray area. You may buy it from a dealer, but perhaps that dealer didn't give you the exact documentation.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a blind eye, hush-hush,
uh-huh.
right? This is the
uh-huh.
amount, and that's it.
And the story comes with it that, you know, I bought it from a dealer, and this is, you know, where it came from and so on. And as we know how stories
exactly.
get it around.
Exactly. And it's always from a private collection,
right.
a private person that really doesn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you want something, and it could very well be true. That's why it's in the gray area, because it's very possible that it was bought in a very correct manner.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, probably not, because later on we find out when there are apprehensions made that these paintings, either at a dealer or usually at a dealer or at a museum, rarely are they caught at a private collection. But once they are apprehended, then they say, well, of course, we'll return them. And so they are returned. So there really isn't there aren't any big legal repercussions other than embarrassment for the dealer or for the museum who then returns the painting.
Right. Cecilia, you had mentioned that indigenous people of Latin America, and what is happening with the languages there? You know, I mean, at one time everybody had their own language, but now we're just, you know, getting such a mishmash of everything everywhere. And I'm wondering, with your experience and your research in Latin America, what is really happening to that indigenous language?
Well, you know, it's a paradox. On
uh-huh.
the one hand, there is definitely a movement of pride of the different ethnicities, and with that, their language. To some degree, the language, at least in the Andean countries, which is Quechua or Quechua, the way in Peru they call it Quechua, and in Ecuador they call it Quechua, there are many, many, there are millions of speakers. So that is a wonderful thing. However, I just returned from a trip to Peru 2 weeks ago,
uh-huh.
and I spent a lot of time in Cusco. And the young people that I met, and in a bit of a more formal way, they were still telling me that they do not teach them formally Quechua in school.
Ah.
So I was dumbfounded because my understanding was that it was being taught in schools, uh-huh. in Cusco having been the center of the Inca Empire and a very proud people. They do speak it, but it's not at school because many times I would ask them, how is this said? And they said, I don't know. I have to call my grandmother. I said, aren't you learning at school? And they said, no, we don't need it. We learn English in school. And, of course, they spoke English beautifully. So yeah. I think it's a paradox. But I think that especially with the awareness of Machu Picchu by the rest of the world and they're having a tremendous tourism in Peru at least,
uh-huh.
I think there is a pride there. And I think that may lead to a bit more of retaining their language, but millions of people do speak Quechua. Now, some of the other dialects, for example, in the Amazon River area, those are gone. I mean, the people have just, the elders who spoke it are no longer there, and very few people speak other than a few mishmash of words.
Uh-huh. With probably a lot of English words mixed in, and pretty soon it becomes just a language that who knows where it originated.
This is true, and maybe and there's an argument to be said about the fact that language has always evolved, and it's always a consequence of history and conquest and so forth. So maybe you cannot mandate what languages can still remain alive.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a huge question. But as far as the Quechua language, it is very much alive.
Good. Good. And I hope it stays that way because I think it's important for us to preserve our heritage, and that language is one that certainly needs to be preserved.
Absolutely, and it's not at the expense of another. I think, you know,
yeah.
if you know the Swiss, for example, every Swiss person, you know, speaks three languages beautifully, and they're not particularly, not just the brightest, any person.
Right, right.
The human mind, we can actually learn many languages, so it's not at the exclusion of just maintaining one mother tongue or two. So I agree with you. I think, and we learn so much from language. There's the nuances that one learns.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Now, let's talk about your book, Gathering the Indigo Maidens. Tell our listening audience the premise of this book. And, you know, since we've covered some of the areas that are in your book, but just tell us what this is really about.
Well, it started with a thought for me about legacy. What is legacy? What does it mean to really leave something for someone else? Is it just your family? Is it culture? Is it your community and so forth? And so that was kind of the thought that first started the book. But because I'm passionate about Spanish colonial art and I'm passionate about where I live, this story just sort of evolved into what if someone called and asked for help? And you're not, it's not a member of your family. Would you really do something about that? Well, what if that person called and threatened you?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of changed the stakes a little bit. And that's why my protagonist, Paloma Subiondo, who lives a very beautiful, sheltered life, answers the phone and gets a phone call that she would have never expected from a young girl, a young woman, claiming that she's been held captive as a sex slave. And if Paloma returns a stolen painting, which the young woman claims to really be the rightful heir, since the painter was an Ecuadorian woman and it was her descendant. So that changed the stakes, and that's how the story evolved.
Now, how much truth is there to your book? I realize it is a fiction, but obviously there had to be some base that, you know, you used that was actually reality.
Well, I think we touched on the three things. I mean,
okay.
Art theft is a reality, the fact that there are young women that are being held captive.
Uh-huh.
And so those two things are very real. And so I knew that would be a strong point that people would relate to it. In terms of many of the characters that are being mentioned in the book, and I do put in the afterword who actually was the historical women, and I think the three historical women obviously are very real,
uh-huh.
and the literature that I refer to, some of the Spanish works of art, all of that is very real.
Uh-huh.
But the actual incidents as they took place in the story are fictional.
Of course. And, you know, as we all know, fiction, a lot of times it could be reality too, so.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so in Indigo, Gathering of the Indigo Maiden, what does the title really mean?
Well, you know, I did think about that title quite a bit. And the Indigo Maidens is a term that I coined because it refers to, on the very literal sense, it refers to several of the women, the historical women, who were linked together by their use of paint or ink. And indigo was gathered during the colonial period in the highlands to make a very, very beautiful cloth, a textile that is woven down there. During the colonial period, it was valued very, very highly. So it started with that notion in the 1600s of the value of indigo to make the dye, uh-huh. to make paints. And then eventually I linked it to Mexico City to a historical printer who used ink for the publishing her books. And that book ended up in the mission San Juan Capistrano. Fictitiously, many books came from Mexico to the missions, but the specific book that I speak about is an example of the same iconography of the Immaculate uh-huh. Conception that started in the early 1600s in Ecuador. And so I wove that whole notion of indigo, the color, as well as how it was used. And the maidens, of course, refers to these historical women and yes, metaphorically also to the fictional women who have been lost to us. We don't know what's happening to these young women. There's a tragedy that's happening to them. So we're gathering them to tell their story, but it also kind of fades. So that's why the whole notion of ink. Ink isn't 100% durable. It does fade. And so some of these lives have also faded from our history.
You mentioned about telling a story. Cecilia, for you, what's the importance of telling our story?
Well, you know, I always think that Toni Morrison said that if you haven't read the book that you want to read, then you have to write it. And so I think that was it. I always, these are passions for me. There's wonderful fiction that's being written now, but not this particular story. And so I think that's it. I think you have to find that unique aspect that moves you, that propels you, that you have to tell the world, uh-huh. and so I think that's it. It's the uniqueness of every story.
Yeah.
And so that's what moved me, and I think that's what moved every writer.
Are you going to tell your story at some point?
You know, I think in bits and pieces I'm kind of telling it, but it's never as, you know, real life is never as interesting as fiction.
Oh, you're funny. So is there part of your story in Gathering the Indigo Maidens?
You know, I didn't think so, but the more I talk about it, I realize that it just comes out, and even though one thinks that one is being very objective, I think it is. Obviously, I collect Spanish colonial art. There's truth in that. You know, because one of the characters is a marriage and family therapist. That was my background, and so I'm familiar with that. I taught English as a second language many years ago. So there's a little bit of that in me. So there's a little bit of many of the characters that have come from my own personal experience and also from the experiences of counseling various people. Some of the more unsavory characters are also a result of that.
Cecilia, your website address?
Yes. The address is www.gatheringtheindigomaidens.com.
There you go, listeners. We've been talking to Cecilia Vasquez, and as you've heard so far, she is very knowledgeable on many of the aspects that she used as a basis for her book. And, you know, as we've talked about the sex exploitation and the girls that are being used as sex slaves, we've talked about the Spanish colonial art, we've talked about languages, and so I know that this book has a lot of deep-seated cultural aspects to it, and our reviewer loved it, so I'm really encouraging you to check it out. Again, it's Gathering the Indigo Maidens by Cecilia Vasquez-Tique. I know that you're going to be really intrigued with it. Cecilia, thank you so, so much for appearing on this show and giving us an insight.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you. And there you go, listeners. Do check the book out. Again, it's Gathering the Indigo Maidens. And this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.